Brethren, I ask a question of you. Have you given it some thought or a lot of thought? Because we have been talking about it on and off. And the question is, will the Jewish people build a temple in Jerusalem before the return of Jesus Christ? Now, this is the introductory question because I have a lot more to say about what's all involved. But we did write several Q&As on that one. And I'd like to read briefly from one of those Q&As and what we had to say. We said the indications are they will. Although there have been feeble attempts to build a new temple ever since the destruction of the second temple of God by the Roman army in 70 AD, none have been successful to date. As never before, there is a rising sentiment advocating the building of another temple in Jerusalem, both from Jews and Christians. And then in this particular Q&A, we go into some interesting developments, one having to do with the Sanhedrin. And we say in there that although there have been several attempts to establish this traditional Jewish judicial and religious council composed of 71 Jewish sages, now that's not Mr. Sage who is here with us and his wife, these are 71 other sages, but it says recent developments seem more focused. This proposed council is considered a work in progress, and the new Sanhedrin will have significant influence if it regains its former role in Jewish life. This is pivotal, for this body was the one that appointed the high priest during the administration of the Second Temple. In addition, the genealogy of Levites has been preserved, and lists of living Levites exist who would be qualified to serve in that capacity in the temple. And then we say later on in this Q&A, contributions and gold have been received from national and international sponsors for the building of the temple, and replica of certain furnishings and utensils for the temple have already been prepared, following the descriptions of the Old Testament. I read that again. Following the descriptions of the Old Testament tabernacle in the wilderness in Solomon's temple. The replica of those vessels and vestments include, among others, the golden lampstand, the table of showbread, the altar of incense, the Ark of the Covenant, and the crown and ephod for the high priest. And in fact, they've also finished a blueprint of that temple. And so everything seems to be ready to go if they get the green light. Now, why is that significant? And how is that significant? And why is it important for us to understand? Several years ago, we published a booklet, And Lawlessness Will Abound. And I know that you all have studied it many, many times. In this booklet, we have a section on the different covenants which God made with the nation of Israel and also with individuals. Now, some have the misconception that there are only two covenants, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. That is most certainly not the case at all. There have been many, many covenants in the Old Testament. For instance, God made a covenant with Noah. He made covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He made a covenant with the nation of Israel. Several, in fact. But he also made a covenant, that's the one I want to talk about today, a covenant with Aaron and with his descendants. And I'd like to read from our booklet a certain portion talking about that particular covenant. It says, at the time of Moses, God chose to make still another covenant with a part of the nation of Israel, Aaron, of the house of Levi, and his descendants. Numbers 18:19, and again, I'm not necessarily turning to these scriptures, I just want to read in context what we say here. Numbers 18:19 calls this covenant between God and Aaron and his descendants a covenant of salt. The subject matter of this covenant was the Levitical priesthood and the sacrificial system, and especially the right of Aaron and his descendants to eat of the sacrifices. God said, all the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Lord I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. And then later on in the book that we say, in time, the covenant with Aaron was transferred to Aaron's grandson, Phinehas, and his descendants. And you may recall the story regarding Phinehas. It's told in Numbers chapter 25, when he stood up for God, when there was fornication going on in the camp, and most Israelites tolerated that, and he stood up to stop it. And because of that, God says, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood. So the priesthood was given now to Phinehas and his descendants, the son of Aaron. And we find several references to this covenant later on in the Bible. For instance, the book of Nehemiah in chapter 13. We find that Nehemiah was forced to reform the priesthood and cleanse it from pagan influences. And that's what we read in this passage. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleansed them of everything pagan. I also assigned duties to the priests and the Levites, each to his service. And then we should all be familiar with the very famous passage in the book of Malachi, where God again talks about this covenant with Aaron and his descendants. In Malachi chapter 2, beginning in verse 4, and I'd like to quote this to you, that is what it says. Malachi chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. Then you shall know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant with Levi may continue, says the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him one of life and peace, the same wording as it was related to Phinehas. And I gave them to him that he might fear me, so he feared me, and was reverent before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is a messenger of the Lord of hosts. And of course, we understand in a spiritual application that this would also refer to God's two ministers today, who are spiritual Levites. But the passage goes on to say, but you have departed from the way, you have caused many to stumble at the law, you have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore I also have made you contemptible and base before all the people, because you have not kept my ways, but you have shown partiality in the law. Clearly, a reference is made again to that covenant of Levi, and this is a prophecy for the future, for our days. And so we say in our booklet that this prophecy for our day tells us that God's covenant with Levi will continue. This means that it is still in force and effect today. And we find a reference to this covenant in the 33rd chapter in the book of Jeremiah. Now, you might want to turn to that particular one. I'd like to read a few excerpts from chapter 33 in the book of Jeremiah. We have quoted this in the past quite a bit when we talk about the covenant God made with David, saying that there will always be somebody sitting on the throne of David. But in the same context, God is also referring here to the covenant with Levi. And so we read in Jeremiah chapter 33, beginning in verse 18, and I'm just quoting a few excerpts from it. Nor shall the priests, the Levites, lack a man to offer burnt offerings before me, to kindle grain offerings, and to sacrifice continually. Thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and the covenant with the night, so that there will not be day and night in their season, then my covenant may also be broken with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, nor the sand of the sea measured, so will I multiply the Levites who minister to me. Close quote. So these passages clearly tell us that God's covenant with Levi was to continue, and that it's therefore still in force and effect today, and that it will remain so in the future. But you might ask, and we ask this question in our booklet, how can this be? given the fact that sacrifices are no longer required since the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that the Jews have ceased bringing sacrifices since the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Well, what those passages tell us is that as long as and whenever sacrifices are being brought to God in Jerusalem, they will be brought through the descendants of Aaron and Phinehas. And God gave those descendants the right, as we have read, to eat from those sacrifices. Now, what we do know is that shortly before the return of Christ, the Jews will start to bring sacrifices again in Jerusalem. We know that because we also read that the beasts will go in, apparently together with a false prophet, and they will stop those sacrifices to be brought, so they will first have to be brought. Christ talked about that very clearly. He talked about the time when the abomination of desolation will be set up, he said, at the holy place. You can read that in Matthew 24 and verse 15, at the holy place. And he referred to Daniel when he talked about the abomination of desolation. What is that holy place? Now, the holy place is always a reference to a temple. As we pointed out in the Q&A, which I mentioned earlier, the Jews have recorded the genealogies of the Levites. So they know exactly who the priests are, who are to bring sacrifices shortly before the coming of Jesus Christ. And we also know, of course, that once Christ has returned, there will be sacrifices given again in the millennium, at least for a while. And you read that in the 44th chapter in the book of Ezekiel. And notice it is again the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, who will bring and eat from those sacrifices, as Ezekiel 44 makes very clear. Now, we also point out in this booklet, just as a side point, that those sacrifices are not going to be given for the purpose of forgiveness of sin. The Old Testament sacrifices were never given for that purpose either. They were there to remind the people of sin. Forgiveness of sin can only come through the sacrifice of Christ. But nevertheless, it appears, and the Bible never clearly tells us as to why sacrifices are going to be given in the millennium, but it appears they are going to be given for the same purpose they were given in Old Testament times, to make people understand how terrible sin is, and to slowly lead them to the ultimate sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But the point I want to address today is this. The covenant between God and Levi continues to exist, is in force and effect today, which means it is going to be the Levitical priesthood which will continue to offer sacrifices in Jerusalem when the time arrives for carnal, unconverted people, both prior to and subject to the return of Christ. Now, Christ became the high priest for converted people. But unless we accept Jesus Christ, his sacrifice, the fact that he is our high priest, who is going to intervene for us when we need his help, who is going to lead us to perfection, we still have to observe that the Levitical priesthood is still in existence with a responsibility to give sacrifices for carnal people with the goal to lead those carnal people ultimately to Jesus Christ, even though they may not realize that yet. But that will be their ultimate goal. See, they resided at the time of Moses, and they will reside again before Christ returns, over the administration of the bringing of sacrifices as a reminder of sin, not for the purpose of forgiving sin. Now, these were just introductory comments because I want to really go into something else which I haven't addressed before. And I was struck reading about that in a book which I picked up. I can't recommend the book because most of what is written in here I don't agree with. It's about the Lost Ark of the Covenant. I don't like his conclusions. It was Tudor Perfit who wrote that book, and he came up with some weird conclusions as to where allegedly the Ark of the Covenant would be today and where it is, and what it is. But he did point out something very interesting. Going back to the point I made earlier, that the Jews know exactly who the Levites are today, who are the ones who will have to bring the sacrifices. See, nobody else is allowed to do that. So when the Jews are going to bring sacrifices again, it can only be done through the Levites. So they need to know who they are. And so they have written records, written down the genealogies. But how can we be sure that those written records are accurate? Is there any additional proof that those written records actually are accurate, pointing back to Aaron? That's a question. Now, this author here has an interesting answer. I'd like to read a few excerpts from what he had to say. Somewhere between the 13th and 15th centuries B.C., the Israelites left Egypt and were led by Moses for many years through the desert areas of the Sinai, Negev, and Transjordan. The Bible tells us that during this period, the tribe of Levi was selected for certain religious duties that included carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Both Moses and his brother Aaron were members of this tribe, and descendants of Aaron and the male line were designated priests. According to Jewish tradition, only males from this direct line, going back to Aaron, could be permitted to serve as temple priests and as servants of the Ark. This strict rule was allegedly implemented from the first tabernacle in the wilderness until the destruction of Herod's temple by Titus in 70 AD. It was essential for the priestly line to be kept intact, as the Bible states that the priesthood should last forever. It would be a covenant of everlasting priesthood. Now, with the destruction of the second temple by Titus 2,000 years ago, the temple priests, and the Hebrew for temple priest is Kohanim, which is plural of Kohen. The temple priests lost much of their function. The things they were chiefly involved with, notably caring for the temple and organizing and carrying out sacrifices, stopped being relevant because, A, the temple was destroyed, and B, the sacrifice of animals was terminated. Now listen carefully. Priestly status is transmitted exactly in the same way as the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is inherited by men from their fathers, whose sperm cells contain either an X or a Y chromosome. When these male sperm cells fuse with a female X cell, which always contains an X chromosome, the sex of an ensuing baby is established. XX combinations producing girls, XY combinations producing boys. Now, if you go back to your biology class, you will perhaps vaguely remember that. The Y chromosome passes from father to son, and that is the only way that it can be transmitted. Priestly status passes from father to son, and that is the only way the status of priest can be transmitted. You cannot be appointed or promoted to the priesthood. You are one if your father was one. A number of genetics had the same inspiration in about 1997. By testing the Y chromosome of priests, they argued it should be possible to see whether today's priests are genuinely descendants of some distant ancestor. The two key players in the unraveling of priestly descent were two remarkable and energetic men, Neil Bradman in London and Karl Skorecki in Israel. Skorecki and his team produced the first paper, which was published in Nature 1997, entitled Y Chromosomes of Jewish Priests. And Bradman's team, some of whom had collaborated with Skorecki, published in the same highly prestigious journal the following year, again in Nature 1998, the article Origins of Old Testament Priests. Now here it comes. Among Jewish priests, or Kohanim, it was found, amazingly, that over 50% of the sample had one specific constellation of markers that became known as the Cohen Modal Haplotype, or CMH. The CMH may clearly be seen as a marker for the descendants of the priests of the Jerusalem Temple. In addition, The research demonstrated something utterly extraordinary, more than extraordinary. It showed that the priests who carried the CMH were descended from a single common male ancestor who lived around 3,000 years ago. It was reasonable then to suppose that the distant common ancestor could have been Aaron, the brother of Moses, who lived at about this time and was a founder of the priesthood. As brothers have the same Y chromosome, it was as if we had discovered the Moses gene. Who would even have thought that the original temple priests were really, as they claimed, descended from a common ancestor? The discovery was received with joy by the organizations in Israel dedicated to rebuilding the temple, as now they had a way, as they saw it, of selecting authentic priests for future temple service. For others of his friends, the discovery appeared to be a confirmation of Holy Writ. After all, the Bible had prophesied that the Israelite Kohenim would be a covenant of everlasting priesthood, and thus they appeared to be. Well, to me, it's not only appearing to be, it's another confirmation. It's a confirmation that the Bible is true, that the covenant with Levi continued, is still in force and effect today. God has seen to it that it can be established as to who those Levites are today. When the sacrifices will begin, it will be administered by the Levites. When a temple is being built, it will be again taken care of by the Levites. As we have seen that there is going to be somebody sitting on the throne of David today, and the throne is in England, as we know, so God has also seen to it that there will be Levites who will be fulfilling that duty of bringing sacrifices, and if there's going to be a temple, administering the temple. So again, to me, it was quite remarkable to see that, and hopefully it helps has helped us and all of us to see again how true the Bible is, how true God is, how much He is involved in our affairs, and how He will make sure that what He has promises, He will fulfill.